is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, a guy I think of as America's senator. People in Vermont know him as theirs. Senator Sanders, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
I saw earlier in the week, and people who watch or listen to the program every day will know this well, that you published your 12 items that we could do to basically take back America or make America work again. And I believe you'd like to go through them and then have people call in and with their thoughts on these things.
Here's the story, Tom. I think, people who listen to the show have heard you and me talk and many callers calling in about the very serious problems facing our country, which is the collapse of the middle class, growing income and wealth inequality, the loss of millions of manufacturing jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So we kind of have talked a lot about the problems, but it's important, equally important, to talk about the solutions. Where do we go forward? What makes sense? How do you revitalize the American economy so that it works for the middle class and not just the millionaires and billionaires? So I was on the floor this week talking about 12 specific ideas, none of which, by the way, people will not have thought of. I mean, not the most radical ideas in the world. But if we were to carry these out, it would very significantly transform our country and especially the middle class of this country. So if you don't mind, let me just go through it. And if people want to call in during the course of the show to discuss these ideas and whether they like them or not, I'd love to discuss it. First thought, the truth is unemployment is not 5.8%. Real unemployment is over 11% if you include those people who have given up looking for work who are working part-time. If we invested $1 trillion in rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, and that's our roads, bridges, water systems, wastewater plants, rail, airports, all of which need work. The people who know most about it think that we should invest $3 trillion to bring our infrastructure up to par. If you did $1 trillion over a period of some years, we could create 13 million decent-paying jobs. And just imagine what America would look like. And all over the country, we're rebuilding our roads, we're rebuilding our rail system, making it much more efficient, having state-of-the-art water systems and wastewater plants, rebuilding our dams. What it would mean to America in terms of making us more efficient and productive, as well as putting millions of people back to work. So rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure and investing in that is something absolutely we need to do. Number two, I think that climate change is real. That's what the scientists overwhelmingly tell us. If we're going to preserve this planet for our kids and our grandchildren, we need to transform our energy system. And that means investing in energy efficiency and sustainable energy, making our homes and buildings much more energy efficient, and moving aggressively to wind, solar, geothermal, and other sustainable energies. And when you do that, the United States leads the world. We create new technologies. We also create jobs. But most importantly, we protect the planet for our kids and our grandchildren. Another area that interests me very much, and I'm excited about it, we're seeing a little bit of it here in Vermont, a little bit in Ohio, is the idea of worker ownership of businesses. And what we see sometimes is business guys who have started a business, they want to retire, and they don't want to see their plant or their business move to China. They want their workers to continue that business. We've got to make it easier for the workers and those business owners to be able to transform that business into a worker cooperative. Instead of giving tax breaks to corporations who want to move jobs to China, I think we should provide tax incentives to businesses that want to transform their company into a worker-owned enterprise. Clearly, in my view, history is not debatable on this, that workers who are members of unions, who are able to negotiate decent contracts and working conditions do much better than non-union workers. Right now, it is, in fact, very, very hard because of employer opposition for workers to form unions. We want legislation that makes it possible for those workers, a majority of workers who sign a card saying they want to be in a union, to be in a union. It goes without saying that we have millions of workers in this country today who are struggling with horrendously low wages. We've got to raise the minimum wage to a livable wage. I was just at a rally in Washington, D.C. yesterday. I think there are about 150 of them all over the country, where workers are fighting for a higher minimum wage, for the right to join unions. Those workers who are working for companies that get government contracts in government buildings, I was out there with them in Washington, D.C., and they want to see the minimum wage raised to $15 an hour. They want to be able to join a union, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Clearly, when we talk about justice, it is not acceptable that women are making 78 cents on the dollar for what a man makes doing the exact same work. We need to make sure we have pay equity in this country, equal pay for equal work for women workers. I think an issue that you and I have talked about but is not talked about anywhere near enough is our disastrous trade policies, that is NAFTA, CAFTA, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China, which have given a green light to many companies to shut down in America and move to low-wage countries. We have lost some 60,000 factories in the last 12 or 13 years. We need to have companies reinvesting in America and not in low-wage countries all over the world. So trade becomes a very important part, I think, of a serious an agenda to rebuild the American middle class. We live in a highly competitive global economy. We cannot compete effectively for good-paying jobs unless we have a well-educated workforce. Some years ago, the United States led the world in terms of the percentage of our people who graduated college. Today, we are in 12th place. Other countries understand the significance and the importance of making sure that their people, regardless of income, get a college education. We do not. So you're having college absolutely unaffordable for a lot of working-class families. Other young people are graduating college deeply, deeply in debt. That's crazy. It's not only unfair to the families and the individual young people. It is stupid for our economy. We want to encourage everybody who has the ability and the desire to get a higher education, no matter what their age is, no matter what their income is, to be able to do so. You know, it stuns me that 40, 50 years ago, some of the great public universities in this country, University of California, colleges in New York City, state colleges all over this country, tuition was virtually free, virtually free. Anybody, regardless of income, could go. Today, we have regressed significantly, and the cost of college is unaffordable for many. So we've got to address that issue and child care as well. If you're a working mom today, it is very hard for you to find quality, affordable child care. We have to deal with the disaster that is Wall Street. When you talk about the economy, we're not going to talk about significant changes in the economy unless you have a financial system whose job it is to get money out into the productive economy. The function of a bank is not an end in itself. It is to take money in and get money out into the productive economy to those businesses and institutes, businesses that are producing real goods and services to help homeowners buy homes, to help people make the investments they need, not to be an island unto itself with the goal of making huge profits just for themselves. And what you see now is Wall Street and the major financial institutions are a world unto themselves whose only job is to make outrageous profits. Furthermore, what we have to do is reform our tax system so that the wealthy and large corporations pay their fair share of taxes. And we've got to protect the elderly and the sick. We have to not cut Social Security and Medicare. We have to expand those programs. So those are some of the areas that I think we can make some huge progress in and improve life for the middle class.
Brilliant. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, your calls for Senator Sanders and your thoughts on his 12-point program to restore America's middle class. And welcome back. Senator, take some calls.
Let's do it.
Okay, Jim in Lockport, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Tom, Senator Sanders, I hope you both had an enjoyable Thanksgiving. My question to the senator is, I noticed that the Congress is pushing a $585 billion defense budget, And why can't we take at least $5 billion of that and put it towards SNAP or our food assistance programs? I think, I think we have enough weapons.
Jim, I agree with you absolutely, and I would go further than $5 billion. Look, we need a strong defense. It's a dangerous world in which we live. But there is tremendous pressure from the military-industrial complex, folks who make huge monies from new weapon systems, to keep spending a whole lot of money on the military. And I will tell you that my Republican colleagues, who will soon take over the Senate, who now control the House, they will go forward, unless I'm very mistaken, in trying to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, nutrition programs, all of the programs that the American people desperately need. And the one area they want to expand spending is in the military. So I strongly oppose that effort. I think you're right. I think we can make judicious cuts in the military and invest that in the needs of the American people.
Corky in Rochester, New York, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator, I agree with all your points for plans to get the economy going. I also like to volunteer to work on your campaign. I'll come to Vermont and sleep in your garage if I have to.
Corky, thanks very much. As I've said many times, I am giving thought to running for president. That is a very, very difficult and monumental decision for my family and myself and for those people who support me. And we're just trying to ascertain the kind of support. If I ran for president, it would be a very different type of campaign. And for us to win, it would require literally an unprecedented level of grassroots activism on the part of people who are prepared to take on the billionaire class and work hard to make that happen. And we're trying to ascertain what kind of support there is out there. But thanks very much for your support, Corky.
Senator, we have just a minute until the break. What does it say about the state of democracy in our republic when a presidential candidate whose positions are supported by well over 80% of America, virtually all of these positions, has to be considering money before running for president?
It's a money situation, and I didn't talk about Citizens United or McCutcheon. Look, it is horrendous, and as I have said many, many times, at the end of the day, what I worry very much about us losing our democratic traditions and moving to an oligarchic form of society. Tom, if you were today a billionaire, you were worth billions of dollars, and you walked into the Washington press room inside the Beltway Media and said, look, I'm worth billions of dollars. I'm thinking of running for president of the United States. If a person, not you, but if a person who no one had ever heard of, that person would be tomorrow a very significant candidate, an important candidate for president of the United States, because by definition, he or she had billions of dollars and could mount a very, a lot of television ads and so forth. And that is what is happening in our country. Money talks. People who have great ideas who don't have a whole lot of money are second-class political figures.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with your calls with the senator right after this. Past the hour. Welcome back. It's Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Mark in Tacoma, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much. First, the United States has a great many problems. I get this. There are two questions, or possibly three, in order to make any changes, you first have to create the environment where these changes can be made, correct?
Yes.
Okay, would you support a constitutional amendment that removes all created entities from our legislative and electoral process and directly ties campaign contributions to our economy? That constitutional amendment is actually posted on constitutional-rights.org.
Well, what I would support, Mark, is the immediate moving as quickly as we can to overturn Citizens United, move to public funding of elections. I think that's the most important thing that we could do now. And that means that ordinary people, rather than just the very wealthy or those candidates supported by the very wealthy, will be able to run for office.
Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi.
There's a lot of talk about the middle class and no talk about the poor. You know, I guess my question is, beyond what you support for the middle class and all of the things that you listed, for people who are hungry, mm-hmm. people who don't have jobs, people where the there's divestment, is that the right word, or disinvestment? I'm not sure which word is correct.
Sequestration, is that the word you wanted?
Well, no, not even sequestration. I mean like Detroit, where the cities are blighted and there's no jobs and there's nothing for them. What are you going to do for that, you know, for like rebuilding the city so that there are places that people want to shop and people want to come and have it be alive again? You know, Detroit is a great example of that.
Well, first of all, I think the first point that you made is that we do not discuss poverty enough. And you're absolutely right. It's not a word I think that was on the lips of terribly many candidates in the last election. And the fact is that we have over 40 million Americans who are living in poverty today. The number is almost as high as it has ever been in the history of America. We have poverty growing among senior citizens. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. So the solutions, I think, what we've got to do is twofold. Number one, obviously, you have to create an economy where people have decent-paying jobs. If somebody has a decent-paying job, they're not going to live in poverty. Second of all, while we attempt to do that, you have to protect those people. And that means we make sure that nobody in America goes hungry, that we learn from countries around the world where the rate of childhood poverty is not 18%, but in Scandinavia and elsewhere it's 3, 4, 5%, because you provide help to moms and dads to take care of their children and provide educational opportunity for those kids, including early childhood education. My Republican colleagues have a Robin Hood policy in reverse. They take from the poor and they give to the rich. My view is that we take from the rich and we give to the poor. We want to help those people who are hungry, and we have a lot of people who are hungry in America. That means expanding nutrition programs, not cutting the food stamp program. But simultaneously, you have to build an economy where young people do not experience 18% unemployment, but are able to go out and get decent-paying jobs and start careers. But your point is turn our backs on the millions and millions of people who are struggling, and that's absolutely right. And that fight is going to come up in the next few months. Our Republican colleagues will want to cut Medicaid, throw more people off of health insurance. They're going to want to cut back on nutrition programs, cause even more hunger in America, cut back on early childhood education, make a bad situation even worse. So your point is absolutely right. We have got to protect the most vulnerable people in this country, the elderly, the children, the disabled, our veterans, and I intend to play an active role in that.
Mike in Upland, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. It's an honor to speak with you. I just have a question, and Tom mentioned like 80% of the American public would agree with your positions, but somehow you and more broadly the Democratic Party and the president are unable to communicate these positions and win elections based on the public supporting their positions. What can you and the Democratic Party do to resolve this?
Well, Mike, that is a very good question. And let me amplify it by saying that everything, or virtually everything, that I have said this morning in terms of what I think is a sensible economic agenda for America is supported by the vast majority of the people. Should we rebuild our infrastructure and create jobs? Yes. Should we raise the minimum wage? Yes. Should we do pay equity for women workers? Yes. Should we transform our trade policy so that it works for workers and not just multinational corporations? Yes. So on all of these issues, we do have support. And you just saw that, oddly enough, in this last disastrous election of a few weeks ago, where the Democrats got their clock handed to them. And yet, in four of some of the very conservative states, and there were four states out there that voted very strongly to raise the minimum wage and then voted for Republican candidates for the United States Senate who were opposed to raising the minimum wage. What do we do about that? Well, I think there are a couple of points. I think you touched on one of them. The truth of the matter is the media in general, which is corporately owned, is not inclined to focus on the plight of
working families. And one of the reasons that I love this particular program is that every week that I'm on it, we hear from real people who talk about the real struggles that they have economically. And for every person who talks, there are hundreds of thousands of people who have the same experience. I don't think the media is particularly interested in that. So what you have the media doing is focusing on sensationalism, or, you know, suddenly there's a great Ebola crisis, and we had weeks of Ebola. But we don't talk about, we have Ferguson. Well, you want to hear the real story of Ferguson? It's not just police brutality, and it's not just young black people being picked up willy-nilly on street corners, on streets all over America by police. It is that African-American youth unemployment is 30%. 30%. We're losing an entire generation. How often do we talk about that? So I think there are a lot of reasons why, but clearly we've got to do a lot better job in getting the word out.
Senator Bernie Sanders will be right back with more of your questions right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your thoughts on Senator Sanders' 12-point plan to revive America. Stick around. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, and in particular on his 12-point suggestion, rebuild our roads, reverse climate change, number two, number three, create jobs, number four, protect unions, number five, raise the wage, number six, pay equity, number seven, making trade work for workers, number eight, cutting college costs, number nine, breaking up the big banks, number 10, bringing health care to all, number 11, ending poverty, and number 12, stop tax-dodging corporations. It's absolutely brilliant. And Bernie, welcome back.
Okay.
Or Senator, excuse me. Let's pick up some calls here. Brian in Springfield, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is with regard to unions and companies. About a month ago, Fairpoint Communications workforce, the contract they have with their union has expired. And rather than work under the bargain contract while they negotiate, they imposed their own contract, which in turn triggered a strike about a month ago. So Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine telecommunication workers are on strike. And I was wondering if Mr. Sanders could give his opinion on that, or if he sees any positive outcome, hopefully, in the near future.
Well, Brian, thank you very much. I am more than aware of that situation with Fairpoint, which impacts the people and the workers in Maine, New Hampshire, and my state of Vermont. And we have met with the workers in the union. I've been on the phone with the leadership of Fairpoint. And I think your description of the situation is exactly right. What Fairpoint is basically saying to the union is if you don't accept major cuts in pensions and in future health care benefits, and if you don't allow us to outsource jobs out of our region for very much lower wages, in other words, continue the race to the bottom rather than paying new workers decent wages, having another tier of significantly lower wages, that's it. That's what we're offering. You take it or leave it. The result has been, I can tell you, and then in these three states, a whole lot of people are now seeing terrible service, and it's a very important issue because telephones, needless to say, are occasionally life and death. If you're having a heart attack or you need medical service or there's a fire in your house or a crime, you need to get to the proper people. And some people are not able to do that. So I think we've seen a significant deterioration in service as a result of Fairpoint's actions. And I am working as hard as I can to demand that Fairpoint come back to the table and negotiate in good faith, which they are certainly not doing now.
Tom in Medea, Pennsylvania. Am I saying that right, or is it Media, Pennsylvania, Tom? You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, that's Media, Pennsylvania. You know, I'm a union person myself. I was a union representative for 22 years. I was a locomotive engineer for infrastructure improvements, highways, rails, and everything. But that benefits everybody, including the corporations and big stores like Walmart that depend upon transportation and have, you know, their fuel costs dependent upon how good the roads are. My concern is the cost, the net cost. It looks like it's going to be $1 trillion a year. But you will have me sold on this plan to the point where I'll support it if you can just give me an answer on two questions that I have. One, you know, what do you think is going to be the net cost per year of providing all these good jobs? And is it going to be just paid through taxes, or the corporations and all going to have to pay for it? Because I'm a taxpayer myself. And number two, are all these new construction jobs going to go to American citizens, or are they going to be eligible for people that just have a work permit that will be allowed to work throughout the country if President Obama's executive action goes through?
Okay, let me answer the first one first. It's not $1 trillion a year. It would be a total of $1 trillion spread over several years. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates we need $3 trillion of work, so let's get to work and do it and put workers back to work. Second of all, Tom, we need jobs for everybody in this country, and I think this business that, you know, I support Obama's executive action. I think we have to deal with the immigration situation in this country, which is now completely broken. People are in this country and get a work permit, they're allowed to work on jobs. But we need to put all of our people back to work. And this is the most significant way that I know to put people back to work, not only at work, but at work at decent jobs. And I don't want to get hung up, and I hope we don't get hung up, on new Americans or immigrants versus people who are born in this country. That's not the issue. It's not black or white or Hispanic or anybody else. It is creating jobs for all of our people. And the fastest way that economists tell us we can do that is by rebuilding our infrastructure. Now, you ask a good question, how do you fund these things? Well, I'll tell you how you fund it. For a start, we are losing at least $100 billion every year by companies that stash their profits in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Luxembourg, Switzerland, and other countries in order to not pay American taxes. And that's an issue I'm going to work on very, very hard. But I think it's time that these large corporations, some of which, like General Electric, Verizon, over a period of years, pay nothing in federal income taxes. Nothing, not a nickel. You pay more than they do. So let's demand that corporations and the wealthy, who are doing phenomenally well, start paying their fair share of taxes. Let's put that money, among other places, into rebuilding our infrastructure. Let's put all of our people back to work. Let's not get hung up. This country, one of the things the Republicans have done very successfully is they divide us and divide us. First it's on race, and then it's on sexual orientation, and it's women versus men. They always do that. Let's put our finger where the real problem is, and that is the greed of the 1%, the billionaire class, who don't want to pay their fair share of taxes. So let's ask them to stop paying. Let's put it into infrastructure. Let's create jobs for all of our people.
Jesse in Plainfield, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah. Hey, Bernie. It's an honor to talk to you. I got a quick question. There's a bunch of us, you know, we work. Some of us make in between the 18 to 22 hour, you know, per hour range, which is a livable wage.
Right.
But if they raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, what's that going to do to us? Like, if some guy's making $18 an hour and you can make $3 less working at a McDonald's and you have no skilled trade, what's that supposed to do to us?
This is what a good question, Jesse. And what I think we do, and I don't think you're going to have a $15 an hour minimum wage tomorrow. I mean, it's going to go up. Right now, the minimum wage at 7.25 is about where it was in real dollars in 1964 or something. So I think, Jesse, when you raise the people at the bottom, you're going to have to raise the people in the middle as well. The most significant economic problem that our country is facing is the growth of low-wage jobs. And it's absolutely imperative that we raise those jobs. So people who are working at $8 or $9 an hour should move up to at least $15 an hour over a period of time. People who are working at $18 or $20 an hour, which is a livable wage, should also be going up. So I think it's a positive for people in that wage bracket. It drives wages up, and that is what exactly we have to do. There was a study that came out recently, Jesse, points out, listen to this, that the average male worker today is making $700 less in inflation accounted for dollars than he made 41 years ago. Women are making less than they made in 2007. So what you're seeing is medium wages the median wage earner going, his wages are going down. We've got to raise those. And I think raising the minimum wage impacts not only the lowest wage increases, it's going to be a trickle-up theory impacting middle wage employees as well.
Bill, in Maine, is it Bowdoin, Maine, listening on AM 670?
Bowdoin.
Bowdoin, thank you. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, and good day, gentlemen. Senator, first of all, I applaud your proposals focus on college students and trying to reduce those costs, because the debt being saddled on the on young people today is almost criminal. It's certainly immoral. But I also happened to spend some time in Detroit, and a caller earlier mentioned it, and that city itself is revitalizing. One of the things I noticed it needs is there are people moving back downtown. They're young people. They're going to start having families. What will keep them down there is good and safe schools. And so I wanted to know if you had any focus on that.
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, I think we need a revolution in this country in the way we do education. And for a start, it might be a good idea if we focused on education and we understood the importance of education. And clearly, as a nation, starting with the very youngest children, we are not giving educators or families the support that they need. From the earliest age, we have a child care system in this country which is a total disaster, which means that millions of kids, by the time they get to schools, which are often not of the quality we want them to be, but by the time they get to schools, are already behind many other kids. So I think, to answer your question, Bill, we focus on education, which means that we make education and teaching an honored profession, a well-reimbursed profession, as many other countries do, and that we make sure that we are not laying off teachers. We're not cutting foreign language programs or art programs because we don't have the resources to do that. A caller earlier mentioned that we were looking at a huge military budget. There are some people who think that it's important that we spend more on the military than the rest of the world combined. I don't agree with that. I would like to see us say, you know, we're spending more per capita on education, and we have the best educational systems in the world. So a lot of ways to do that, but we should certainly focus on the fact that in the need for every kid in this country to get a quality education.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie. More of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the way that I got Senator Sanders' 12-point plan is by subscribing to the Bernie Buzz. You can do that over at Sanders.Senate.gov. And welcome back. Yvonne in Kingston, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hi.
Senator Sanders. I worked and grew up in Michigan, and I'm all for unions. My question, and I love you, 12 points, is as far as infrastructure, is that each state hires their own workers and starts their own unions to so every state has people working.
Sure. Now, this is... this is a 50-state program. Every state in this country has infrastructural needs, and the state should be the entities that are identifying what their needs are. In some states, the need is going to be roads, and other states it'll be bridges, and other states it will be rail, and other states it'll be water systems or wastewater plants. Each state will have, I think, their own set of infrastructure priorities, and those states should be given the power to make the decisions as to where the money is going.
Imogene in Fresno, California. You're on the air watching Free Speech TV on Dish. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Imogene? Or Imogen? Apparently she's not listening to her telephone. Tom in Tucson, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Bernie, if this country spent not just $3 trillion more, but $5 trillion more to take care of all our needs for the time being, would it hurt the American capitalistic economic system if this country went in debt another $5 trillion?
I didn't hear the first part of the question clearly.
I think essentially the question was, if we're going to spend $3 to $5 trillion over some years to do everything you're talking about, and some or all of that gets added to the national debt, does that cause a crisis?
Good. Okay. Good. Good question. Tom, here's my response. The reason that the deficit and the national debt has gone up so much in recent years has an enormous amount to do with the fact that we fought in a war in Iraq, which will eventually end up costing us some $3 trillion unpaid for. We have given huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country, which will cost us huge amounts of money. We have a tax system in general, which allows for huge loopholes for corporate entities that are not paying their fair share of taxes. And I think if we had a fair and progressive tax system that asked the wealthy and large corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes, we could raise the revenue that we need to, in fact, invest in our country without driving the deficit up. And in terms of the deficit, let me say this. I know many of my Republican colleagues talk about the deficit all the time. When Bush left office, we had the largest deficit in American history. It was $1.4 trillion. In the last 6 years, we have driven that deficit down very, very significantly, way below 50% of what it was. And compared to our GDP, we are in reasonably good shape. So it is a problem, but not a major problem. The more important problem is the collapse of the American middle class.
We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in just a moment. It's 10 minutes before you. Welcome back. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting with the Senator. Keenan in Manitou Springs, Colorado. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. How are you doing today?
Good.
Good. Well, anyway, I just wanted to get on with you again. I spoke with you last week from the perspective of the youth in our country. And as a person that only makes, I literally make $9 an hour. I make about a little over $200 a week after taxes. It comes out to like $12,000, $12,000-something dollars a year. And I just want to know what we can do as young people that are just getting the screws put on us so hard. You know, my boss makes about $1 million a year, and we all make about $9 an hour. That's pretty, you know, it's pretty standard these days, and they're basically screwing us to the point where we can't really do anything.
Keenan, I think, and thank you for raising that issue, because I think we do not pay enough attention to what's happening to young people. And I recall your call from a couple of weeks ago. We have a generation that went out into the labor force after the Great Wall Street Crash, where it was very, very difficult to find jobs, and often if people did find jobs, they weren't in line with their educational background. What I think we need to do, as I've mentioned earlier, is I think for our lower-wage workers, we need to make sure that low-wage workers are not earning starvation wages, and $9 an hour today is totally inadequate. You can't live on $9 an hour. Tom, you may have seen there was a piece, I think, in the Huffington Post where some person mentioned that, I think it was a woman, who worked in McDonald's in Denmark. And she said, I work in McDonald's in Denmark, and because of labor negotiations, I make $20 an hour.
Right. Yeah.
Working in McDonald's.
Talked
well,
about
I've talked to McDonald's workers in this country who make $7.50 an hour. How does that happen? How can McDonald's pay $20 an hour in Denmark and $7.50 in this country? And the answer is they have union contracts or negotiations which raise those wages. So we have got to, if people are going to work in the fast food industry, or in the, I'll give you another example. I was out in Nevada a couple of months ago, and they have a culinary workers union there, which has been enormously successful in making sure that those people who work in hotels, who clean beds, who do work that has been traditionally very low paid, those workers now, because of a decent union, are earning living wages. They're earning you know, $18-$20 an hour. They have good health care. So we can't, we don't have to identify that working in fast food or working in a hotel necessarily means starvation wages. It doesn't have to be that way. But that has a lot to do with the building of a union movement to protect those workers. So as I also, you know, mentioned to the caller, I think we got to focus on education, making sure that people, regardless of the income of their family, if they need more education for better paying jobs, they should be able to get that education. They should be able to do that. And that we need to create millions of decent paying jobs in this country. So there's a lot that we can do, but I appreciate the caller focusing on the fact of the problems facing our youth. Youth unemployment today, nobody talks about this, is over 18%. African-American youth employment, over 30%. Those are issues that have got to be focused on.
Claire in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hi, Senator. First of all, thank you so much for having the courage to tackle the issues you tackle and speaking the truth in this insane world. My question is, how do we get more people thinking the way you do so we can have these conversations and effect some change? And hopefully you run in 2016.
Well, thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
You raise, you know, the last election to me was obviously demoralizing for a number of reasons. I think the wrong guys won. But maybe even more demoralizing was the fact that something like, what was it, Tom, 36% of the people voted?
Yeah, in that neighborhood. It was low.
And that 80% of young people didn't vote.
Right.
So I think, Claire, you need what, you know, I would call a political revolution in the sense of in a number of different ways, making it clear to working people and to young people that they live in a democratic society, and more of them really don't understand what democracy is about. And they do not believe that the political process is significant toward improving their lives. And in a variety of ways, through education, through organizing, we have got to change that. I was thinking, you know, when I was mayor of Burlington way back when, I was elected in 1981 to be mayor of Burlington, Vermont. The first thing I did, I think even before I took office, after I was elected, is we had these very large town meetings. We brought people together. And we said, okay, what are we going to do for youth in our community? What are we going to do for economic development in our community? What are we going to do for women in our community? And huge numbers of people came out. And we listened to what they had to say. And then you know what we did? We started implementing those ideas so that people said, wow, my voice makes a difference. And 2 years later, when I ran for re-election, we had almost a doubling of the voter turnout. Because people said, you know what? Government is listening to us. I'm beginning to see things happen. So I think it's a chicken and an egg. I think we've got to organize people, put pressure on political leaders, get good people to run for office, make things happen, and make people see the difference. If you're marching in the streets for a higher minimum wage and we get that minimum wage, you're going to say, hey, government and politics mean something to my life. I've seen some results. If we get health care as a result of the efforts that we make. So we got to organize, we got to educate, we got to make things happen, and we got to make people see the difference in their lives because of political activity.
Senator, we have just 25 seconds to wrap up the hour.
I hope people pay a lot of attention to what's going on in Washington right now. Congress will shut down in either a week or 2 weeks. Some very, very important issues are out there in terms of tax extenders, whether or not we give more huge tax breaks to large corporations and ignore the needs of low-income people and the needs of sustainable energy. And there is a very large omnibus bill out there which is going to refund the government, and we should be paying attention to what is in it and what is not in it.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us this week and every week.
Thank you, Tom. It is
such a pleasure. And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter, get all the information. You can find him over on Facebook. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday, although I want to start out by talking about how Chile, the country, has changed and why.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Well, another day, another unarmed black man shot by a cop. In this case, it was Romain Brisbane. He was delivering fast food to his kids when a police officer pulled up his car, And there is a narrative of this, which may arguably make this justified somehow, in as much as apparently he ran away from the police officer and the police officer got in a scuffle with him and thought that the pill bottle that he was apparently protecting in his pocket, I would guess, because he wasn't supposed to have it, but I don't know. I don't know what the situation is. But anyhow, the cop thought this was a gun, and so he shot him. But still. That said, I mean, is this always the first thing we go to? Is this anyway? It's continuing, right? It's continuing, and protests are continuing all over the country about the Garner case, about Michael Brown's case, Eric Garner's case, and others. So, you know, keep your eye on this. One of the reasons why I want to talk about Chile, the country, and the reason why I started out with white cops killing black young men is because that has led to a series of demonstrations, of protests. Now, let me throw this into the context of South America and history, which I find just absolutely fascinating. Robert Hunziker has written a great piece on this. It's called Chile's Neoliberal Flip-Flop. It's over at Dissident Voices, dissidentvoice.org, excuse me. And, you know, he points out that back in the day, 1974, to be specific, this was the tail end. It actually started with a coup d'etat in 1973, the last year of the Nixon presidency, when Henry Kissinger was in the White House. And Salvador Allende was, you know, overthrown and murdered, and the people of Chile got General Augusto Pinochet, along with a bunch of economists from the University of Chicago. They called them the Chicago Boys. They were all disciples of Milton Friedman. And they were preaching what today you would refer to as Paul Ryan economics, libertarian economics, conservative economics, Tea Party economics, Republican economics, any of those categories probably fall into this. The way that economists refer to it and Europeans refer to it is neoliberal economics. That's confusing to a lot of Americans who think that, you know, neo means new. Is this the new liberal? No, it's not. It's, you know, in Europe, they refer to conservatives as liberals. Seriously. I mean, you know, economically. Because what they would say that conservatives are doing is make the rules more liberal for the corporations and the rich people. Get this? So it's kind of confusing. But in any case, in 73, the neoliberal, they had never successfully flipped a country from being relatively democratic socialist, you know, sort of like the United States. You know, you've got a good social safety net. You've got, you know, or at least a social safety net with minimum wage and health insurance for very poor people, housing and food support for very poor people, retirement, you know, the Social Security, a third of Social Security providing for widows, orphans, and disabled people. So basically, you've got a social safety net. Milton Friedman's idea was do away with all of that and don't replace it with anything coming from government. Just stand back. And what will happen is corporations and the magic of the so-called free market will just create it all. It will create a paradise. Now, this is a stupid idea. It is a fantasy. Ayn Rand pitched it in her book Atlas Shrugged, and others, The Fountainhead and others. Paul Ryan has been pitching it every year in his budgets. It has never successfully been tried in any country in the history of Earth. There have been two high-profile attempts in my lifetime. One was in Chile, the one I'm telling you about, and the second one was in Iraq. And most Americans don't even know this. This was like a one-page story back in 2003. When the United States invaded Iraq and they were looting the national museums and the banks and everything else, and because Paul Wolfowitz and L. Paul Bremer, Secretary of Defense. Who was the Secretary of Defense? Don Rumsfeld. Thank you, Jim. Don Rumsfeld and L. Paul Bremer, at the behest of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, but I think that they really were taking it a step further, said, hey, now we've got this country that was very socialist, right? The Ba'athist Party is a socialist party. It was called the Ba'athist Socialist Party. And so they said, we're going to fire everybody who's a member of the Socialist Party, which meant every member of the military, because you had to be a Ba'ath Party member to be in the military in Iraq. Virtually everybody who worked in any government industry or business. And by the way, government businesses were more than half of the GDP of Iraq at that time. Okay, if you want the measure of socialism, for example, the average state in the United States probably has around 12, 13, 14% of their GDP being state spending. Mississippi is up over 20%, the most socialist state in the United States. The poor states tend to be the most socialist. Alaska is number two. But anyhow, Iraq was 50%. And so he said, we're just going to rip all that out. Fire a 500,000 men out of the military, close down these state-run industries that are making steel and that are producing electricity and that are cleaning the water and the sewage and all that. We shut them all down. Privatize it all, sell it all off or give it away, and wait for the billionaires to come in and make it all wonderful. Well, take a look at Iraq. You can see how well that worked. So in Chile, and that was version two. Well, the first one was in Chile. It was in 1973, really 74. Pinochet is running the place. If you want to see a movie about this, check out the movie Missing. It was made in 1982. It was taken off the market for a while. The right-wingers really didn't like this movie. It's back. I'm guessing you can find it on Amazon or Netflix or something, but it's called Missing. And it's based on a real story. This is Pinochet's cold-blooded massacre, basically, of people. So what happened was Milton Friedman and his Chicago boys got together with the people of Chile, with the new president of Chile, the dictator, Pinochet, who was actively murdering the opposition. And they said, okay, that's it. We're going to privatize Social Security. We're going to start private schools. We're going to privatize the schools, school voucher programs. We're going to privatize the healthcare system, voucher programs. We're going to get the government out of all these areas, and we're going to invite the billionaires in. And, it was a disaster. It was an absolute flaming, screaming disaster. And now Michelle Bachelet has been reelected, the National Congress. They've got this new majority. It's called Nueva Mayoría. It's a center-left coalition made up of Bachelet's Socialist Party, the Christian Democratic Party, and the Party for Democracy. And they're running this thing. They raised corporate taxes from 20 to 25%. They closed tax loopholes on companies and business owners. They are providing money for free education for all Chileans as of 2020. It's going to ramp up to that. They're improving their healthcare system. They're rolling back the for-profit schools from Pinochet. They're doing all this stuff. Why? Because students started demonstrating in the streets. This is blog over at Dissident Voice, Robert Hunziker article. He said it's all about student debt. In 2011, students in Chile made headlines by launching nationwide strikes over high tuition costs that drove their families into debt. That strike lasted for 8 months. Over time, the student march has gained recognition by other like-minded organizations like trade unions and protests of environmental degradation. And basically, they formed a coalition and they rebooted Chile. We can do that here. And I see these protests against police violence as a tip of the spear for this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I would love to see a movement to eliminate student loan debt merging or joining with the people who are saying enough with the racism already, and let's build a national movement. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And let's pick up some phone calls here. Clifford in Ishpeming, Michigan. Hey, Clifford. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Yeah. I wish I could have gone on with Bernie because maybe he'd have an answer. Maybe
next week.
Caucus. Yeah. Well, anyway, my thing was this, is that, you know, we've done terrible in the election. So I spent 3 hours in, you know, this week in Debbie Stabenow's office. And my complaint was, is that, you know, okay, just one point. When President Obama made his speech about the aliens, you know, he made a point. This is not amnesty. And he went on to explain what it did.
Right.
The next day, because that wasn't carried on ABC, NBC, and CBS, the next day, Boehner was on the witch and really lashing out at him because, you know, he's doing, you know, bad things and this and that. Nobody came forth with, well, there's a bill for a year and a half now. Why didn't they take it up? He won't allow it there. Why? This is why we lost. Democrats refuse to answer these things and keep answering them. And Republicans keep lying. And you know, if you tell a lie long enough, people will believe it.
Yeah. It's the other problem, though, Clifford, is that you've got media, you know, all the big media in the country is owned by large corporations. And then even NPR now increasingly is funded by big corporations and billionaires. So that I believe it was yesterday, might have been the day before, there was a conversation between one of the NPR hosts and one of the NPR commentators in which he was saying, you know, is Obamacare really helping? Well, it's only covered 10 million people, like, you know, it's no big deal. And why not, you know, so many more people? We got 40 million people uninsured. Well, it turns out that about half the states chose not to expand Medicaid. And rather than saying, why is that? And it's, of course, because these are Republican-controlled states and they're committed to destroying the presidency, the Obama presidency. And so they're willing to let their own citizens die from lack of health care rather than go along with something that has the Obamacare name attached to it. Rather than saying that, or even asking a perhaps less inflammatory question, which is, you know, why is not so much why is that, but what could be done about that? Well, you know, legislatures could choose to take this money and you know, or, you know, have any Republican-controlled states done that? Well, yeah, Arkansas did. They figured out a way to fund, you know, first cycle the money through for-profit corporations, so not as many people got health care. And a bunch of, you know, corporate donors to the Republican Party got rich, but at least people got something. They didn't do any of that. Instead, they just moved along to the next question. No discussion whatsoever of partisan politics. And this is a huge problem, Clifford, in the United States. Republicans go on television, say outrageous things, either lies of commission or omission. Nothing is said. There's no pushback. And as you point out, very often the Democrats don't push back. But on the other hand, very often the Democrats do. And the media completely ignores it. And Clifford, thank you for the call. That's a huge problem, is the media ignoring when the Democrats are pointing this out. We'll be right back. Thanks so much for watching Free Speech TV, by the way. And they're in their fund drive now. I just mentioned that. It's worth paying attention. And if you're listening on a Pacifica station, they may be too. We'll be back. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fast food workers strike adds momentum to movement. Kevin Fagan writing over at the San Francisco Chronicle SF Gate website. What's going on here is small R revolution. People are saying, all right, enough. as Eric Garner said, just, you know, before he was choked to death, this ends here. This stops here. Now, I think he was referring to the shakedown stuff that the police used to do, stop and frisk in New York City. And in fact, there's been some suggestions that the reason the cops were so aggressive with him was, and have been with a lot of people, apparently, you know, arresting as many people as possible, is because they're not allowed, you know, because the new mayor, Bill de Blasio, said no more stop and frisk. They went from like, you know, several hundred thousand down to maybe 10 or 20 or 50,000, something like that, over the course of the last year. Could it be that the police were basically retaliating against everybody? Who knows? But the net of this is that we've got movements emerging in the United States. The first movement is the low-wage workers movement in the fast food industry. It seems like a standalone movement. Then you've got the low-wage workers in the big box industry, the Walmart, ourwalmart.org. That movement is emerging. And then you have a new civil rights movement, essentially. People across the country, and increasingly not just African Americans, a lot of white people, Hispanic people, whatnot, showing up for these rallies, for these marches in cities all over America, saying, you know, hands up, don't shoot, I can't breathe, enough, Black Lives Matter. There's a bunch of slogans here that all basically tie into the same meme, which is this system is corrupt and racist and destructive, and it's got to be changed. Now, as more and more movements emerge and people start getting active, I think the possibility of our moving in the direction that Chile has done, which is what really has the right wingers in this country paranoid. I mean, they're looking at Chile going, oh my God, could happen here. And what drove it in Chile was students saying, you know, this whole Chicago boy thing, the whole neoliberal thing, the whole Milton Friedman, the miracle of Chile and all that kind of nonsense has destroyed our country. Just like 34 years of Reaganomics have destroyed the United States. They destroyed our country, Chile. And we're going to go back to first principles. We're going to go back to a country that works. We're going to go back to modeling our country after Scandinavia, after countries that actually work. And I think there's a very real possibility that Americans could be doing that too. And I would love to see more students out there, you know, protesting student debt, and more unemployed people out there protesting the fact that there are no jobs, that our jobs have all been shipped overseas because of insane trade policies that the Democrats have offered a number of solutions to this, including doing away with the tax breaks that a corporation gets when they move jobs overseas and replacing them with tax breaks for moving jobs back. Republicans filibustered it. It's all about the billionaires for them. It's not at all about the working people. And if coalitions were to start to form among these disparate groups who are basically protesting the state of the country, I think a lot of change could happen. I'm very optimistic at this point in time. Ed in Gloucester, Mass. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Oh, hey, how are you? Waiting a long time.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk to Senator Saunders about this. I like what you're talking about now, but let me throw out my idea for Senator Saunders before. I wanted to mention to him about doing away with the XL pipeline and replacing it with a national aqueduct that might help it with our drought regions and the farms in the western part of the country. But that was something for him. But now what you're talking about now is very interesting, because I do see it as the tip of the spear, and I do see these demonstrations are just something that is just starting people to realize that there is a lack of respect coming from a lot of authority in a lot of different places, as you articulated much better than I did. And as far as Milton Friedman goes, his Chicago School of Economics has destroyed more countries than just Chile. He's been thrown out on the rail in a few countries. I think even Israel is one of them.
Oh, and they destroyed they were there when the USSR came unraveled, and it's one of the reasons why a lot of the former Soviet bloc countries are basically, you know, run by oligarchs. They're plutocracies.
Exactly. That theory. I remember Hubert Humphrey, when this whole trickle down crap started, was what's wrong with percolator, is how he termed it, the trickle down, percolator. So you're absolutely on the right mark. I think there's more coming. It has to do with women. It has to do with minorities. It has to do with how healthcare treats conversation. There's a lot coming, and if we haven't really gotten to that yet.
Yeah.
But it's coming. I'm agreeing with you 100%. It's almost like I'm talking to myself when I'm listening to you. But my other thought was the National Aqueduct thought, and I wanted to run that by Senator Saunders, but still listening, maybe he'll hear it.
Quick thought on that, Ed, is that the Keystone Pipeline goes from Alberta to the Gulf Coast. There's plenty of water along that route. It's west of there that the water is needed. So you really need if you're going to run an aqueduct line, if you're going to move water around for agriculture, for residents, you really need to run it east to west, not north to south.
Yeah, but it's all part of infrastructure. It all plays into the whole thing of infrastructure. And by the way, about these people that complain about, oh, my taxes, how are we going to pay for this? When you run a Keynesian like working, building roads and that kind of thing, you ought to keep the economics. These programs pay for themselves as people earn more money.
Dwight Eisenhower borrowed what would be $1 trillion in today's money to build a national highway system. It generated, by the end of his presidency, at least $2 or $3 trillion in economic activity and continues to this day. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's Anything Goes Friday. You can pick your own topic. I've shared mine with you. Continue right after this. The bad and the very, very glabrously ugly. The good. Darren Soto. On Tuesday, the Florida State Senator introduced a bill that would ban hydraulic fracturing or fracking in the Sunshine State. Although fracking hasn't made huge inroads into Florida just yet, Soto is worried about what kind of effect it could have on the state's tourism industry. He's also worried about what kind of effect fracking could have on Florida's water supply, which mostly comes from underground aquifers. When you consider the risk, banning fracking really just is common sense. Let's hope the rest of the Florida legislature gets on board with Soto's plan. The bad. Gretchen Carlson. As news broke Wednesday afternoon about a grand jury's decision not to indict the police officer who killed Eric Garner, the Fox so-called news anchor worried about what effect the news could have on New York City's holiday celebration. Seriously. Check it out.
We're hearing that the grand jury has decided to not indict that officer. And once again, Arthur, I just want to point out that there have been these protests in Times Square right outside of our building here for the last week or so since the non-indictment came down in the Ferguson situation. So, I mean, I certainly hope nothing's going to happen here in New York City today, and we've got the tree lighting ceremony.
Okay. Seriously? Cop just got away with murder, and you're worried about the friggin' Christmas tree lighting? Unbelievable. And the very, very ugly Republican Congressman Peter King. The New York Republicans' reaction to the grand jury's decision not to indict the cop who killed Eric Garner was beyond offensive. Check it out.
First of all, the death was tragic, and our hearts have to go out to the Garner family. Having said that, I feel strongly that the police officer should not have been indicted. I've been following this case from the start. You had a 350-pound person who was resisting arrest. The police were trying to bring him down as quickly as possible. If he had not had asthma and a heart condition and was so obese, that almost definitely he would not have died from this.
That's right. Eric Garner's death was his own fault because he was overweight. It doesn't get much uglier than that. That is very, very. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And get my mouse working here. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Anything goes Friday. What is it about gold? I know that gold is important in our current technological society. But what happens if the world economies collapse, a.k.a. your book, The Crash of 2016, gold is just a soft metal. You can't make a hammer with gold. So if I had to choose between an apple or an ounce of gold, which in this possible new world would mean gold is useless, I would choose the apple. What do you think, Tom? Thanks.
Well, it all depends on how bad things get, Michael. If there's no apples, then they become more valuable than gold. If there are a lot of apples, then they don't. The the thing that I think is important, number one, gold is just a commodity and people can invest in it or not. I think that gold's run-up is pretty much done. I think the gold is on a downswing now, but it's just my personal opinion. I'm not an investment advisor, just, you know, what I'm seeing as I look out there. And I think this drop in the price of oil is going to drive down a lot of commodity prices. So you're going to see, you know, right across the board, you're going to see gold go down, silver go down, tin, pork bellies, wheat. Who knows what all. And to some extent, that may have to do with Dodd-Frank and the fact that the banksters are having to get out of the commodities markets, which means the commodities are going to start going down because the banksters aren't skimming money off the top of them anymore. The other point about gold is that there is a contingent, mostly within the far right, but there are some people who consider themselves lefties who think that we should be on a gold standard, that the dollar should be backed by gold and that we should have no more dollars than we have, you know, X number of ounces of gold in Fort Knox kind of thing. That's a really, really, really dangerous strategy. Having a currency that is backed by precious metal reserves might work well for a small country or for an emerging country. But when you've got a country that's got substantial infrastructure and, as we do, and substantial wealth, I mean, some $50, $60 trillion worth of assets that the federal government has, across the country and not to mention, you know, goodwill and all these other things, it makes a whole lot more sense for the country's currency to be based on the full faith and credit of the country, which is what pretty much every country in the world, every developed country in the world has gone to, which is a fiat currency. And it offers a lot more flexibility, because the fact of the matter is, if you have a gold-based currency, if your economy picks up and starts to grow, you're going to have to buy gold like crazy in order to back up the expansion of the number of dollars in the economy. And then if the economy collapses, as it did in 2008, then you need to be selling gold like crazy. And who's going to buy it? I mean, it's an unnecessary, in my opinion, an unnecessary burden on a country. David, and it makes recessions, and this is the thing that we saw in the United States, is it makes recessions worse. David in Hilliard, Ohio. Hey, David, what's up?
Oh, it's good to talk to you, Tom. I've talked to you before. I just had a few work with me here. I tend to be a little wordy, but I had a moment of clarity, and it seems to me that the royalist oligarchs are parasites. And what's happening is they laugh at us because we're made to pay for everything while they pay nothing. Now, thing is, maybe we've been overthinking this, because you need to, and Bernie, and I called when Bernie was on, if he's going to run for president, he needs to get down to that level of the low information voters, because when someone tells you you're being called stupid, you've been taken advantage of, and they're laughing at you, that's going to get more people out to vote than all of the other things that don't work. And, you know, when a parasite takes over, sooner or later it's going to kill the body. And we need to stop this now, because this is getting pretty serious.
Yeah, I don't disagree. The effect of a portion of the billionaire class on our economy has reached the point now where it's a net negative. And I think the simple way to deal with that is to just roll back Reaganomics, to raise the top tax rate back up to 74%, and do like Chile did. Chile did away with our equivalent is called carried interest, which allows people like Mitt Romney to pay a maximum 15% income tax rate. If you make your money with money, basically a capitalist tax rate rather than a working person's tax rate. We call it capital gains here in the United States. And they did away with that in Chile, or substantially modified it, so that even their billionaires are having to pay taxes now. And thus they're funding their government. So, David, excellent points. Thank you for the call. Marty in Monroe, North Carolina. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, sir? I caught your show yesterday. Didn't have a chance to get through. But I believe that the entire justice system of this nation needs to be revamped to treat everybody equally. We need to get rid of the thin blue line that the cops have about the secrecy that goes on within the individual police departments. And as far as the white privilege goes, I'm a white male. I got a ponytail. I ride a Harley. I get pulled by a cop about every day for something that I did not do.
Right. So what you've done is you voluntarily inserted yourself into that category of persons which police officers see as not, white middle class or upper middle class men. Instead, you're one of the outsiders rather than the insiders. So,
well, I'd rather be on the outside looking in because, you know, it's just like the government sets these standards. And as long as that person or people play within the box, the government don't look at them. The government looks at the people that's trying to get away with shenanigans.
Yeah.
On the outside of the box.
Yeah, I get your point. Marty, thanks for the call. Todd in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Todd.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. You wanted to talk about minimum wage?
I appreciate you having Bernie on every Friday. It's nice to hear a senator on your show. I wanted to talk about, and this is a little wordy too, but I want to talk about really how the Democrats and Bernie, I think, is misreading the election that they just got wiped on. And that is the fact that, yes, states voted for minimum wage, but they voted for different minimum wage. I mean, in Arkansas, $8.50 may be a doable wage. It may not lead to poverty. Whereas you live in New York City, you might need $15 an hour.
$8.50 an hour is still poverty in Arkansas, Todd.
Well, that's what they voted for.
I mean, yeah, I know, but it's like you get what you can get, right?
Okay.
It's,
all I'm saying is that the Democrats want to make everything on a federal basis, just like just
no,
like
they're not suggesting that. They're suggesting that in 1968, the federal minimum wage in today's dollars would be about $12.40 an hour, and in 1968, the economy was doing just fine. Thank you very much. And all they're suggesting is that we should take the minimum wage back to where it was in the 60s.
And
what's wrong with that?
All I'm saying is that the states can do it themselves. Can they?
Oh, the states have always set their – some of the states have always set their minimum wages higher than the federal minimum wage. The federal minimum wage needs to be the point at which we say collectively, you know, we don't want people to fall through this hole. We don't want people to – you know, here's the absolute minimum that somebody should have to live on. And, we do that with a combination of the minimum wage and a whole bunch of different, essentially, welfare programs, you know, food stamps and housing support and child tax credits and low-income tax credits and all these kind of things. If we simply raise the minimum wage, we could do that all with a wage. Todd, thank you for the call. After the break, come back. I want to play at some point today. I want to play Teddy Roosevelt talking about a living wage. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, anything goes Friday, although we will have, I believe, Talk Radio News is going to drop by a little bit. Welcome back. Deacon in Boulder Creek, California, watching Free Speech TV on cable there in California. What's up, Deacon?
Hi, Tom. I don't think there was any probable cause to arrest Eric Garner. You need evidence that he committed a specific crime.
Right.
That he committed that crime. I don't see that. That makes the entire arrest and the resisting arrest unconstitutional.
Could be. But still, even if there was a reason to arrest somebody for selling loose cigarettes for 50 cents apiece, there is no reason to kill someone for doing that.
The difference is, under Title 18, Section 242, if you violate somebody's constitutional rights while acting under the color of state law, you can be given a life sentence.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I've got that law.
And that applies to every cop that put his hands on Garner, not just whatever the coward's name is.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. Deacon, thank you very much for the call. Diane in Silver Springs, Nevada. Hey, Diane.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to talk about my ex-husband, who was a deputy sheriff, L.A. County deputy sheriff in the late 60s. And I lived a life of sheer horror with him. I took beatings, everything else. But I asked him one day, I said, do you ever lie when you go to court? He said, of course I do. Who do you think they're going to believe, me or the defendant?
Wow.
And Mike Farrell knows him. He is on death row. It's very hard for my kids. My daughter said they're going to put a diaper on him and kill him. And so...
This is your ex-husband?
Yes.
So he went from being a police officer in L.A. County to being on death row?
He was on America's Most Wanted, even, yes.
Whoa.
Yes. But we've lived, my daughter was a baby when I finally got divorced. He used to beat me unmercifully. And he just lied when he got up in court on those people.
Yeah.
And I feel terrible about it. But
yeah.
That's the truth. Most people will believe a guy in a suit.
In a uniform.
You know,
yeah.
Uniform.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't indict all police officers, but it does demonstrate that, you know, one bad apple can go a long way. Diane, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Got a minute to the break. Cliff, quick one.
Okay. Several points I want to make, but I'm going to be very quick about it, okay?
Thanks.
I think that basically this police brutality thing where there's been a whole spate of black males being arrested and being brutalized, I think that's sort of like a way to get even with Obama in the fact that basically what they're telling blacks is, well, you cannot participate in our electoral system. Another thing, seems like the right likes to think that they own this country. They like to think they own the American flag. Just listen to Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and whoever else there is. And that's essentially what you're going to be hearing, is that they like to think that only they are the ones that have a patent on the American flag.
Right. Yeah. No, I get it, and it's become basically the logo of the right wingers, which is really sad because we need to take it back. Cliff, thanks for the call. In fact, this was, I think, a moment in his campaign when the president was Senator Obama, and he decided to start wearing an American flag on his lapel. Remember that little kerfuffle where the Fox News was like, "Oh my God, he doesn't have a flag on." Well, okay, I'll put a flag on. Yeah, yeah. We need to take that logo back. 10 minutes before the end. It's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. Talk Radio News brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Happy Friday.
And to you.
I see that you are at the White House.
I am in the basement, indeed.
Okay, so what's going on in the August chambers above your head?
Yes, I just ducked out of the briefing with Josh Earnest. Where he assured us that he does, in fact, seek candid strategic advice from his defense secretaries, that is, President Obama. And the reason he assured us of that is because President Obama this morning tapped policy wonk Ashton Carter to oversee the Defense Department, heralding his new nominee as the nation's foremost national security leaders, one of them. Carter is expected to be easily confirmed by the Senate, putting him at the helm of a department moving back into military conflict in the Middle East. In fact, Senator Jim Inhofe said earlier this week, Republican of Oklahoma, that it would be an easy confirmation. And in his brief remarks, Ashton Carter did in fact say, if confirmed in this job, I pledge to you my most candid strategic advice. And Obama looked a bit flummoxed by that. Interestingly, current Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel was not present at the remarks. He had been invited to attend, but said in a message to the press that he wouldn't attend because he believes strongly that this day belongs to Ash Carter and his nomination, and that this is a day to celebrate Ash, his family, and all that he will accomplish. Well, you could tell from the questions that were being asked in the briefing room today by reporters that nobody believed that for a minute.
Or they think that Hagel's feeling burned?
I think so. I think they do believe that, yes.
Very
yeah, because they believe that he resigned under pressure.
Yeah, yeah, and apparently he did.
Yeah, nobody believes that for a minute.
What else is up?
The White House today hailed the strong November jobs numbers as a sign that more robust economic growth has taken root. President Obama touted the 321,000 jobs added in November. He said the pickup in the pace of job growth this year has been in industries with higher wages, and overall wages are rising, a very welcome sign for millions of Americans. Now, this makes the labor market's fastest expansion since the 1990s, with the private sector leading the way. It means we've created nearly 11 million jobs over 57 straight months. The unemployment rate stayed the same at 5.8%. He said, and he made these remarks with Ashton Carter, it's worth us every once in a while reflecting on the fact that the American economy is making real progress. I should note that Republicans said that we should have these numbers every month.
Yeah, of course. Nothing's ever good enough for the Republicans.
President George W. Bush says that the controversial decision by a Staten Island grand jury not to indict a white police officer in the chokehold death of Eric Garner, who is black, is hard to understand. This is in a clip of an interview with CNN. It was posted today. He said, you know, the verdict was hard to understand, but, you know, I hadn't seen all the details. But it's sad that race continues to play such a kind of emotional, divisive part of life. I remember back when I was a kid in the 70s and there was racial riots with cities being burned. I do think we've improved. But he did talk about people destructing law enforcement, which is a shame because law enforcement's job is to protect everybody.
To protect and serve, not to occupy and contain.
He didn't say that.
Yeah, no, I did. Back to you.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, says she's going to consider criticism of controversial Treasury Department pick Antonio Weiss very seriously while weighing his nomination. Now, Weiss is an investment banker and the Obama administration's pick to be permanent undersecretary for domestic finance. And his nomination has been heavily criticized by Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, and other progressives because of his close ties to Wall Street. And critics are also saying his expertise is largely in international, not domestic, deal-making. And Gillibrand said on MSNBC that she thinks Warren's very clear. I'm going to look very seriously at this issue. What's interesting about this is that Gillibrand gets a lot of money from securities and investment industry, one of her top contributors.
Hmm.
So that is signaling a broadening of questioning of his qualifications. Last month, community bankers joined opposition to Treasury nominee Antonio Weiss. So there's quite a drumbeat of opposition to him.
This could also be signaling a weakening of the power of the bankster lobbies.
It could be signaling that, indeed.
Yeah. Okay.
Fewer immigrants were deported in the last year than at any other time in President Obama's tenure, according to a report out today. Deportations of individuals caught crossing the border were down 9%, according to preliminary numbers from ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The government also removed fewer immigrants who were already living in the U.S. Those deportations dropped 23% for the year ending September the 30th, although border crossings were actually up 15% during that period. And those...
You're talking about illegal border crossings?
Yes, illegal border crossings. That was probably driven by this unprecedented surge of Central American migrants rather than immigration from Mexico.
Yeah.
And the drop is probably because of the Obama administration's decision to focus on deportation efforts on criminal offenders and border crossers. Because of immigrants who were deported during the year from inside the country, 85% had a criminal conviction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're likely to see these numbers cited by Republicans as they go after Obama as being soft on enforcement.
But he's kicking the criminals out of the country. I mean, isn't that a good thing?
He's kicking the criminals out, but he's not kicking as many people out.
Oh, I see. Okay. You know, this. You look at Sweden. Sweden's left-wing government is on the verge of falling apart over the issue of immigration. This is a very, very divisive issue.
Yeah, particularly Syrian immigration, my understanding.
Yeah, they've opened the doors to Syrians on a virtually unlimited basis. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great to see you. Have a great weekend. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 7 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And anything goes Friday. Marshawn in Chicago. Hey, what's up?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Marshawn.
Thank you, Marshawn. What's on your mind today?
Listen, I listen to your show a lot, and I'm glad I was able to get in. But I wanted to say something about this Eric Garner situation.
Sure.
I'm a black man, 34 years old, college. And what people, I think most white people don't understand about black people and what it's like to be black is that people automatically assume that they know you. They assume that they know music you listen to. They assume that they know, a single family with a single family home or no father or listen to rap music or, you know, in that situation with Eric Garner, they just totally went way beyond. Even if they felt like, hey, we're doing the right thing to get this guy down on the ground. When I said 11 times, hey, you to me. At that point, you got to find a new way to get the guy. And I mean, as simple as that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said earlier, for those that, you know, don't, and some white people that don't understand what it's like to be black or don't understand this particular situation with Eric Garner, you just got to look at it through our eyes. You know, people just assume that they know you and they don't.
Here's a parallel that maybe white people can get, Marshawn. If a white person puts on, you know, gets a nice clean haircut and clean shaven, a white man, and puts on a suit and a nice top coat and carries a briefcase, there's going to be all kinds of assumptions, and there's going to be reactions to that person based on that as they walk down the street, as they interact with vendors, as they interact with anybody. People are going to make assumptions. If that white person, on the other hand, was to put on a wig with a long ponytail and put on a motorcycle, a biker's outfit, as one of the guys called earlier actually said, this is who he is. He's got long hair. He's a biker. And he gets stopped by the police every other day for something. Then there's a whole completely different response to that. The advantage that white people have is that they can change their clothes and they can change their hairstyle, and they literally will change the way the world reacts to them. And I can, you know, tell you that from personal experience as a young person, as a teenager, having had, you know, long hair down on my shoulders and been involved in both civil rights and anti-war protests, where I ended up getting tear gassed and CS gassed and arrested and all kinds of awful stuff. You can change your identity as a white person. As a black person in the society, please correct me if I'm wrong, it's a hell of a lot harder to change your identity because your skin is...
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And like I said, you know, people, right off the bat, you know, if you look at me, for instance, you know, I don't look my age. You know? Sometimes when I'm not at work, I wear earrings in my ear, you know, but I always dress nice, you know, I read. And for me, the situation is more about the history of how we've been treated in this country. I have a book. I can't remember who the author is, It's called Negroes in the Civil War. And these guys are begging President Lincoln to let them join the Union and fight for their country. And they weren't allowed until the Union was, you know, beginning to lose. And then Lincoln decided, hey, we need you guys after all. But we're talking for how many wars have we fought in? And we're still fighting for our civil rights, still fighting to be seen as a human being. But I also look at this thing, and I know a lot of your listeners and probably yourself will disagree with me. I also look at this thing from a biblical standpoint, and that, you know, the Bible says in Hosea 8:8, the Israelites, which I believe the so-called black man is, will be treated with like a vessel wherein there's no pleasure. And that's not necessarily the fault of the white man or wherever, you know, so-called black people are. It's just because of sin. You know, it's because of behavior. That's what's got us to this point. And until we begin to treat one another and love one another, no matter what our color is, this world is always going to be, and this country is always going to be messed up.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, Marshawn. I think it's a good point that you're making. I'm not sure I'd put it in a biblical wrap, but I think it's an excellent point. Thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to the program there on WCPT in Chicago. Morris, listening on KPFK in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Hey, Professor, let's lighten this up a little bit. Let's fantasize for a bit. Let's say the time we're in charge of the mass voter registration campaign in this country for the purpose of overcoming voter suppression laws. And let's say the Bill Cosby sent us the $50 million and the Center for American Progress said we needed to get going. Would you send the check back?
Probably not. I don't know, Morris. Hypotheticals are a tough one. I think, though, that the case of Bill Cosby illustrates a larger issue in America that is not being noticed. And that is that when people have money or fame or both, and typically the two go hand in hand, they have power. And when people have power, they feel free to abuse the powerless. Some do. And assuming that at least some of these allegations against Bill Cosby have some ring of truth to them, the powerless in the 60s and 70s and 80s were women and still are. I mean, you know, women have less income relative to men. They have less power relative to men. And within racial categories, you know, black women relative to black men, white women relative to white men, you can measure that difference in power in terms of their presence in the workforce, in terms of their presence in powerful positions, political positions, things like that. And
you know, if we're going to really understand this country, because it really is not a simplistic thing. There's a lady by the name of Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She wrote a book called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. And then there's a second author by the name of Dr. Horn. He wrote a book called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. Now, if you read those two books, you'll understand that our problems in this country socially or whatnot, they're not very simple. It's like, well, black versus white, I wish it were, but it really isn't. So take a look at those two books, and then many of the listeners, and then, you know, I think you'll probably have a better understanding of how we got to where we are today.
I will check it out. The Native Americans or the Indigenous People's History of the United States has been recommended to me a couple of times, and Amazon's starting to recommend it to me. So apparently, I got to read this book.
Check out The Counter-Revolution of 1776, because that really will shed light on just how complicated things are in this country. But it'll also shed light on just how important the concept of whiteness is to America.
Yeah. Okay. Right, I'll check it out. Morris, thank you for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. Valerie in San Diego. Hey, Valerie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have some food for thought. Okay. You know, when the governors want to drug test everybody for their food stamps, I don't know if they have really thought about what kind of things that if they do test positive, mm-hmm. what are they going to do? Dump them off of food stamps? And if they dump them off of food stamps, what are they going to do for food? Do they think that's going to make them stop doing drugs? Or are they going to turn to crime to try and get some food?
Yeah, I think the latter is the obvious answer to that. This is something that is, you know, Scott Walker, Rick Scott, Rick Snyder in Michigan, these three guys, by and large, are leading this charge to drug test people before they can get food stamps or before they can even get unemployment benefits. And I think it's just shaming the poor. That's all they're doing. They're shaming people who don't have the kind of wealth that, you know, the white middle class has, basically, or that the middle class has. And it's as you point out, Valerie, and you're so right, it's counterproductive. It's counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense. It's going to help out. I mean, Rick Scott down in Florida, he I don't know if he still owns stock in it, but he owned a company that does drug tests. So, you know, there may even be a hidden agenda there. Valerie, thank you for the call. And then, of course, you got a whole bunch of companies that do drug tests. It's a very, very profitable business. And they lobby these Republican governors, and Republican governors being Republicans, of course. If a big corporation comes and says, we can write a check, they say, oh, cool, how high shall I jump? We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But I think most importantly, they're using this let's drug test food stamp recipients as a way of pandering to an awful base. Welcome back. Ed in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Tom. I believe we can defeat these big corporations that are trying to kick us under the bus, paying us peanuts and stuff.
Okay, how?
What we need is to have each citizen in these United States contribute $3 a week to a county acts committee at a local community bank or credit union. And $1 of this money would go towards the county acts committee, and they'd put 40% into gardens, fish farms, beekeeping, orchards, things like that, to wipe out the pollution that's in our air, and also to provide people with fresh, non-GMO food. And then the other 40% would go to small business loans of up to $50,000. With the extra 20% going for administration, we'd have one office that would handle payroll taxes for all the businesses, all the gardens and stuff going on. You know, they'd handle the insurance, the workers' compensation, all that stuff. Every worker would make a minimum of $15 an hour, maybe 20, and then this would drive the price of Walmart and everything up. They'd have to pay more money to their employees because we would have nobody at the top earning $1 million, $2 million, $8 million, $15 million.
Right.
And then the second dollar would go towards your state acts committee. And the state acts committee would provide loans for small businesses up to $250,000. A third dollar would go to America acts, which would provide loans up to $5 million for big businesses. And once a year, this America acts would give each state $50 million, you know, because they're going to pull in $70-80 million a week, you know, if roughly a quarter of the people get involved, and they just give them $50 million to each state once a year and say, you know, do what you can to stop the environmental damage to our country, whether it's solar panels, wind farms, wave technology, depending on the climate of, you know, the area they have to work with, you know, whether they have lakes or ocean or whatever to work with. But that way we could make America energy independent. I mean, there'd be no corporations, no profits, because everything that's manufactured by these companies would be sold to the members for cost plus 10%. And the 10% would go to the owner of the company, the guy whose idea it was, you know, and the rest of the money would stay right in your county, right in your state, right in your country.
Ed, you should organize something like that in Erie, Pennsylvania.
I intend to. I've written a letter that I'm sending out to the Erie Times News on Monday.
That's great.
And try
to get people together on it. I mean,
we'll take it from there.
Yeah. When I was writing my book Threshold, the last chapter of Threshold is about worker-owned cooperatives and businesses like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Louise and I went to Spain and saw Mondragon, but I also went to Madison, Wisconsin, and write about Peninsula Manufacturing, which is a tool and die shop, basically, or a high-tech electronic manufacturing facility that's entirely worker-owned. The Union Cab Company is entirely worker-owned. These are worker-owned co-ops. They're very successful. The people there are very loyal to them. They have excellent pay, excellent benefits, because there's no guy at the top who's sucking everything off.
That's right. We would have one central office in each county that is handling all the businesses, insurance, and payroll and everything.
Yeah.
So that there wouldn't be all this repetition of effort, you know.
Right. Yeah, great idea, Ed. Thanks a lot for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. I wish you the very best. Keep us up to date on how it works out in Pennsylvania. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with more of your calls here on Andy Doe's Front. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and let's check in with Andy Borowitz for our Borowitz Report, our news report for the day. Andy writes, new proposal would provide grand juries with eyes. On the heels of an initiative to provide police departments with body cameras, there is growing support for a plan to supply grand jury members with eyes, advocates for the plan said on Wednesday. Body cameras are an important part of the solution, said Harlan Dorison, who is lobbying Washington to equip grand juries with a sense of sight. But I strongly believe that if you take video evidence and add eyes, the combination would be unstoppable. Some critics of Dorison's proposal say it does not go far enough, that in order to process information from their eyes, grand juries would also need to be fitted with working brains. Yes, Dorison said, in a perfect world, all grand juries would have brains, but progress is an incremental thing. Let's start with eyes and eventually work our way up to brains. Thank you, Andy. Do you have that Teddy Roosevelt living wage clip that I mentioned in the last hour? Teddy Roosevelt, back in the day, this was the Republican president of the United States. This is a recording that was made by Thomas Edison himself. And Teddy Roosevelt, keep in mind, this was 1912 when he was running as president, third term as president of the Bull Moose Party, which he lost. But he was a good progressive at the time and throughout his presidency. And he said, we stand for a living wage. And then he said, a living wage is different in different parts of the country for industrial production. He said, a living wage is different in different parts of the country, but it has certain minimum standards. And I'm paraphrasing here. It's been 6 months or a year since I've heard this, so I'm just doing it from memory. And he said, a living wage means that you have enough that you can support a family with, without having to resort to theft, basically, with good morality, that you can have a, well, let's play it, and we can pause it as we go through, because it's kind of hard to hear, because literally this is a recording that was made by Thomas Edison more than 100 years ago. President of the United States, Republican President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt. Here he is.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
Pause it. So wages, we stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a reasonable standard of living to people engaged in industrial operations. Here he goes.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
Varies from place to place.
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living. A standard high enough to make morality possible.
Make morality possible. You don't have to steal food for your family.
To provide for education and recreation,
to put your kids through school, to put your kids through college, to be able to take vacations.
To care for immature members of the family, to raise your children. To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
In other words, you've got to have health insurance. You got to have enough to pay for that health insurance and the health care.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
In other words, a pension to be able to set aside some money to accumulate some wealth. Is that the end of the clip? That's the end of the clip. So this is that's Teddy Roosevelt. This is what the Republicans were pitching in 1912, a living wage. And here we have Senator Bernie Sanders in 2014 talking about a living wage. 102 years later, we are still fighting the billionaire class that does not want working people in America to have a living wage. And, you know, we successfully fought them back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, but then they took over again with the Reagan Revolution. And we are now back facing the same battle that Teddy Roosevelt was facing at the beginning of the last century. It's mind-boggling. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to make two quick points here. I absolutely agree with you. I think if you make things miserable enough for so many people, then, you know, hopefully we'll all get together and defeat this, you know, 2 or 3% that run everything. And I wanted to make another comment about what happened in Chile. It took a lot of years for all of that to be undone, and I'm glad that finally situation is improving there. But after that revolution, which we had a big hand in, justice just has not been done there as far as our part of that. And I refer to, many people believe that George Bush, who was head of the CIA, George Bush Sr., was involved in orchestrating that. Also, they allowed the Chilean secret police to kill the ambassador right, not very far from where you are in Washington, D.C., and there was never anything really conclusively done with that. An American citizen also died in that. And when Pinochet went to Great Britain, Britain did not honor its treaty with the EU and send Pinochet to Spain, because many Spanish citizens died in Pinochet's reign of terror.
Where he was arrested.
I just wanted to make those points.
And here's another point to make. This is what Henry Kissinger, when he was the national security advisor to Richard Nixon when this coup happened, here's what he had to say about it. Quote, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people. The issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves." End of quote.
And I just wanted to make one more point. The gap between the rich and the poor in Chile grew to such an extent that I believe they were the most unequal society on the face of the earth when it came to that gap between the richest people and the poorest people. And, people went from being relatively, well taken care of to being poor, and children came to school hungry. There was a lot of malnourishment. And just the whole atmosphere of fear there was just horrible. People literally did not even talk about politics for, many years until Pinochet was out of power. But that man was, not really there was no justice there.
No. He was killing people. I mean, and burying the bodies or murdering people in the stadium and then burying the bodies in mass graves. This is welcome to fascism, the merger of corporate and state interests, which is what Pinochet brought about for Chile. The wonders of the Chicago school.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday right after this. Before they are, welcome back. ALEC is having their top secret meeting where several thousand Republican state legislators are meeting with several thousand corporate lobbyists and buyers of votes and influencers of the public and whatever here in Washington, D.C. And Think Progress tried to get in. They got kicked out. Last year, it was Dana Milbank got kicked out. The year before that, we had live on this program. He was then a state representative. He's now a U.S. congressman. I'm drawing a blank on his name. Anyway, he got kicked out. Yeah, Mark Pocan. There you go, Mark Pocan. So anyhow, ALEC is doing that. Here's the I'm just going to share a couple of quick thoughts with you and then pick up your phone calls. Alaska, this is also over the Think Progress blog. These are all from Think Progress. I think they're fascinating. Alaska did a little variation on Sam Brownback. Let's cut taxes to stimulate the economy, right? So they cut taxes on the oil industry in Alaska, which is the principal source of revenue for the state. And now the price of oil is down and the taxes are down, and there was no boom as a result of cutting the taxes. The oil companies just said, oh, cool, thank you for the money. We'll distribute it to our shareholders instead of you distributing it to the citizens of Alaska with the Alaska Permanent Fund. So the citizens of Alaska got screwed. The oil companies made out like bandits. Yeah, it's like, when are we going to learn? Now, here's the one piece of the every now and then you notice in a story a little codicil, a little hook that's inside it, a little piece attached to it. You go, whoa, maybe that's the story behind the story here. And I don't know if this is the case, but I think it might be. That in the story of this white officer who killed an unarmed black man who was carrying a pill bottle, the officer had chased this guy for a little ways, and he was in this apartment building, apparently, and had this scuffle, and this is where he shot him. And one of the witnesses on the scene said that immediately after the officer shot this guy, he was literally running around, like jumping up and down, very, very upset, the police officer, yelling a word over and over and over again. I'll modify the word slightly. He was basically yelling, duck, 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 only, you know, a variation on that word, and very upset. And I think that what happened is this white cop, it suddenly hit him after he had pulled the trigger. Oh, my God, I'm the next Darren Wilson. I'm a white cop. I just killed a black guy who's unarmed. I'm the next guy whose name is going to be all over the newspapers. I don't want that. Damn. And so he's walking around stomping his fist and yelling basically, damn, 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 I can't believe that I did that or that happened. And if my read of that is correct, what it means is that after these 3 months since Michael Brown was killed and all these young black people who have been killed in the intervening days and weeks and months, and several of them have bubbled up to the point where they break through and become A-list stories in the news and drive the news cycle, in fact, that police officers across the country are starting to get it. You know, used to be you kill a young black guy who's unarmed, nothing happens. But now you kill a young black guy who's unarmed, you might end up on the evening news. And that might not be such a good thing. And you might end up with Eric Holder and the Department of Justice coming after you, and that definitely isn't a good thing. So maybe it's time to think twice before getting so trigger happy. Now, maybe I'm just, you know, being my perpetual optimist here. I, you know, to use Reagan's old story, I'm the guy who's always looking for the pony. But that said, I, you know, I read that and I thought, whoa, that's interesting. Could it be that we're at a turning point? Now, you know, or a tipping point. I mean, here's the thing about tipping points. You only can recognize them in the rearview window. You can only see a tipping point long after you've passed it. But have we passed a tipping point in the United States now? Or are we at the precipice of one with regard to how police treat people of color? And then the next question is going to be, you know, how do police treat everybody? And can we form coalitions between students who are in debt, people of color who don't want to be shot at, low-wage workers at McDonald's, low-wage workers at Walmart, people who have been thrown out of their homes and are screwed as a result of the banksters, people who are part of the long-term unemployed and who are screwed because John Boehner refuses now for 12 months, 11 and a half months, has refused to bring to the floor of the House of Representatives a vote to extend long-term unemployment benefits. People who discover that their vote has been taken away from them. I mean, there's all these factions. I don't want to use the word faction because a faction is a group who's looking out for their own self-interest to the detriment of society as a whole. There's all these groups of people who provide a natural coalition. Are we at a major turning point? I think, you know, if the stock market crashes again, and I think it's going to, that's why I wrote The Crash of 2016. If the stock market crashes again, if things get bad, as they will, if we continue down this road of Republican austerity economics, that even more Americans are going to be out on the streets and we're going to see significant reform. I really believe that. Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I had an us versus them question, but in the meantime, while I was waiting, I had what I consider to be a bit of a brainstorm. Mm-hmm. And if it's okay, I'd like to do that.
Sure.
And share it.
Go for it.
Okay. The writings would have us think that social needs should be handled by charitable organizations, private groups, or the individual states. Okay. Now that's okay as far as it goes, but what if it doesn't meet the need that exists in a community or in a state?
Right.
Here's my idea. These organizations and charitable groups have to send in some form of tax documentation indicating what they take in and what goes out and how it's dispersed. So there's a way to verify how good a job they're doing to take care of local social needs. That being the case, if I'm correct, why not make it a law that let the charities and the private groups do their thing, but if it doesn't fully meet the need, the balance has to be handled by social programs from the government. That seems to be a plan that would make everybody reasonably happy.
Well, that's what you're describing is what happened in 1933. You had 12 years of Republican rule from 1920 to 1932. And during that time, there had been, you know, there was a huge stock market crash. Poverty had been increasing all through that time, by the way. The Roaring Twenties were only the Roaring Twenties for the people at the very top on Wall Street. For the average American, standards of living were declining. Poverty was increasing. Working people were losing rights steadily through these 12 years of Republican rule. And when it really, really got bad, people were in breadlines. I mean, there was nothing. And you had an Occupy movement here from the steps of the White House down to the Potomac River, the Bonus Army. I mean, all this stuff was going on. And FDR came in and said, okay, you know, in his inaugural address, as I recall, he said, better the occasional mistake of a government acting in charity than the frozen heart of a government. I'm forgetting the phrase, but basically, you know, better that we do good and occasionally make a mistake than that we just cut people off and say, you know, we're above that. We're not going to do that. So what you're describing, I think we've already done. We just need to learn how to do it again.
Well, that is the question. How do we productively behave in a manner that's consistent with bringing something like that around again? Because God knows we certainly need it.
Yeah.
I don't know how well you're doing, but for me, it's a month to month thing to, you know, stay above water.
It is for most Americans. It is for very much most Americans. And this, in fact, only about a third of Americans are earning enough that they're not sliding deeper into debt every year. You know, which is just a horror show for this country. So, yeah, I'm with you, Scott. I'm with you. Thank you for the call. Bert in Groveland, California. Hey, Bert, what's up?
Good morning, Tom, and thanks for addressing the serious issues that you address on your show.
Thank you. We have just a minute to the break, Bert. A quick one?
Yeah, I'm interested in the rules of engagement for police forces. I don't think they need to spend millions in training. It seems to me the guidelines of common sense and respect for the individual would go a long way with these rules of engagement.
Yeah, they need WWAD. What would Andy do? What would Andy of Mayberry do in this situation?
Yeah, for example, the first two orders given often, I guess, are hands up and get down on the ground. And it's hard to do both those things at the same time.
Right.
And in these most recent examples of what's happened with the police, two of these people were down on the ground and ended up dead.
Yeah.
And the other, the little boy, didn't have a chance to get down on the ground. He was shot to death immediately.
Yeah, in 2 seconds.
So I'm wondering if there's any difference between whites and blacks in terms of how many people are ordered to get down on the ground. I wonder about the wisdom of even ordering people to get down on the ground.
Yeah, I've been stopped by cops a lot of times in my life, you know, in traffic, and I've never been, get out of the car, put your hands on the top of the door, you know, this kind of stuff that from what I hear is fairly common, the common experience for African Americans. Bert, thanks.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And this is the thing, you know, white people don't even think about that privilege that they have of being able to walk, drive or walk without being harassed. Welcome back. Robert in Gray Court, South Carolina. Hey, Robert, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yes, good afternoon. I was just wondering if you might shed some light on the police brutality, or someone like yourself wrote a book and called it Unsafe on Any Street.
Oh, a play on Ralph Nader's old title, you mean?
Yes, yeah. Yes, that was my thoughts exactly.
Yeah, that would be a great title, and somebody should write a book like that or some variation on that. Robert, thank you for the suggestion, and great to hear from you. Kathy in Morrow, Ohio. Hey, Kathy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Tom. I have a different perspective. I've been listening, and no one has brought this up, but I really think that all of this racial stuff, especially white versus black, started with the first State of the Union address that President Obama gave, and when the white guy yelled out, "You lie," and then Alito was shaking his head no, it showed so much disrespect for the president who was black, not even whole black, but half black, that every, I have to stop and calm myself, every racial person on the street decided it's war, and I can get away with whatever I want to. If Congress can do it, I can do it.
I don't, you know, so Kathy, you're saying because the black president got dissed by some racist white Republicans, that therefore black people in this country decided we can get away with things. It looks to me like the exact opposite has happened.
White people thought we can get away with doing what they want.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you know, in other words, I'm a white cop. I got a black possible perpetrator, whatever, you know, a person in front of me. If a white congressman can yell "you lie" at the black president of the United States from Congress and have no consequence, I can take down this guy in this low income neighborhood.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And I think if President Bush would have thrown him out, I think if President Obama would have thrown his butt out, then things would have been different.
Yeah, I doubt it. But, I'm not sure that Bush would have thrown him out. But, nobody, to the best of my knowledge, and I might be wrong. I mean, it might be that previous State of the Union addresses have been heckled by members of Congress. But I don't think so. I think that about as far as it gets is they will sit there silently on their hands, basically, not responding if they don't like what's being said. And they stand up and applaud when they do. I mean, it's just that's how it's always been with Congress. But I think your point about the disrespect being showed toward this president and his attorney general and any of his African-American appointees is conspicuous and raw. And
exactly.
And people of color in this country get it. And Fox so-called news does their very best to basically cover it up, to keep these things as separate incidents. There's no pattern here. There's no trend here. I guess Jon Stewart did a whole funny thing on it, or maybe it was Stephen Colbert, on that very meme that Fox so-called news is putting out. And, everybody is pandering to the white racist base, particularly in the South. It's really sad. Kathy, thank you for the call. I really think that Kathy's onto something, that so much disrespect has been shown to our first black president that, well, It, on the other hand, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking white cops have been killing black people forever in this country. I mean, since the 1600s. And so, you know, I don't think it necessarily takes the election of a black president to make it, you know, happen. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum of WID, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica, Sirius XM, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, the various cable companies that carry our program, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to The Progressive, which will be back on Free Speech TV at the right after the first of the year, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, hello, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and most importantly, to you for supporting our program. Whether it's just listening, whether it's buying a podcast, whether it's contacting underwriters or sponsors and thanking them, thanking the radio or TV station that you're getting our show through, however it may be, thank you for supporting us. It means a lot. It means an awful lot. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. The first thing I want to ask is that I be given the courtesy to say what I call to say, because the last time we talked about this subject, you instantaneously marginalized and dismissed what I was trying to say. So I'm asking for the courtesy to hear me out and let
Certainly.
Me finish.
My apologies, first. Wayne. I don't have a recollection of having done that, but I'm sure
okay.
you're right.
Anyway,
so go for it.
This is about the Ebola virus.
Hmm.
There's a Canadian pharmaceutical company by the name of Tecmyra. They were given a $140 million contract from the Department of Defense. Officially, the Department of Defense is listed as a collaborator. Now, there's a identifier, NCT-020-417-15. That is the Ebola clinical trial identifier. That is the test that was going on in Sierra Leone. It started January 9th, 2014. And what it was a first in human study, meaning that it was the live Ebola virus was injected and infused into healthy male and female subjects. The clinical trial was suspended following a clinical hold because the Sierra Leone government shut it down. So what I'm saying is that the Department of Defense, the CDC is involved in this too. They were over in Africa injecting live Ebola virus into humans, but the original recent outbreak broke out in Guinea. I'm still trying to figure out how that happened, because the actual experiment was conducted in Sierra Leone, but
well,
the government shut it down.
Wayne, what if the, if you get a flu shot, you can get a live virus flu shot. You get a polio vaccine, you can get a live virus polio vaccine. They're called attenuated viruses. They've been disabled.
Live Ebola virus, man. We're not talking about a flu shot.
No, I understand.
We're talking about infusing and infusing healthy male and female subjects with live Ebola virus. And I'm going to tell you something else. The South Africans were working on a race-specific, genome-specific part of an Ebola virus before apartheid was over with. So somebody's probably picked that up, too.
The problem, one of the problems with that is that there's not really a gene for race. I mean, race is more of a social construct. There's you got the more genetic diversity in Africa than any place else on Earth.
Okay, that's what the South Africans were working on, a gene-specific virus to affect certain groups of people.
Yeah.
So my whole point is, it is true what people like Dr. Francis Boyle, who has a PhD from Harvard, and he has a law degree, and he has a degree from the University of Chicago. He's not a conspiracy nut. It is true what he was saying. They are over in Africa and other places around the world messing with these diseases, testing them on populations. It's just evil. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. Well said. Linda in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind?
Hi. I totally agree with the previous woman who called about the disrespect. If you can malign the president constantly, like it's been going on for 6 years, it's not that hard to disrespect the life of some unknown black person,
yeah.
In this country. And I've thought that for some time. But I'm calling to say how betrayed I have felt by the Obama administration, that he talks a populist talk and then acts more like a moderate Republican. Examples to back me up are, I think when Walgreens was trying to do the inversion and backed off from it, the government, his administration came out against inversions, yet he's nominating Anthony Weiss.
Right.
I understand that his administration has been working on the TPP since he got into office. And you had to know that that is going against your base. It's going against unions. It's going against environmentalists. I have thought, like, I don't even know why black people support him still so much anymore. He did away with public sector programs that helped the majority of black people more than white people. you know, they were the hardest hit by a lot outsourcing. And so I have so many problems with the Obama administration.
Would you rather we were discussing the extraordinary efforts of the John McCain or the Mitt Romney administration?
Pardon me?
Would you rather we were discussing the benefits of the McCain or Romney administration? Do you think they would have done a better job?
Not, Tom. Of course not. Of course not. And I worked hard to get Obama elected. But what I'm saying is
Linda, if I may, we're out of time, but I agree with you. We have to push the president. We have to push our politicians. We have to hold them accountable. We absolutely have to. Thank you for the call. That said, we also have to live in a world of political realities. And I think, you know, unless we start infiltrating the Democratic Party, we're going to have a really rough time. Have a great weekend. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.